Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second.
Hello, listeners of Fully Booked. Our podcast network, Podcast One, has a brand new app for you to discover the show. Find out everything about your favorite Podcast One shows, including Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, through the all-new Podcast One app available now in the App Store or on Google Play. Find links to articles, social media, make playlists with your favorite episodes, and connect with other Fully Booked fans. You can even create your own polls for the latest book releases. We have our own little community on there. Check out exclusive content such as behind-the-scenes photos and so much more. And if you have 360-degree video or watch a bunch of shows in virtual reality, there's over 1,000 videos on the app right now. It's like you're in the studio. There is no other podcast app like this one. Download the all-new Podcast One app in the App Store or on Google Play today.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
He's sitting on a coffin that he will soon occupy. He realizes the Nazis made one mistake, and the one mistake they made is they did not handcuff him.
Robert de la Rochefoucauld didn't have to be a French resistance fighter sabotaging the Nazis during World War II. He came from a very long line of French aristocrats, and he could have laid low for the duration of the war. Instead, he got caught by the Nazis three times, slipped through their fingers three times, and blew up Nazi factories and rail lines. This incredible story is told in debut writer Paul Kix's new book, The Saboteur, which we gave a starred review to. Kix is a deputy editor at ESPN Magazine, and his writing has appeared in a variety of publications. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. So, you know, it really is true that there's something kind of bizarre and extraordinary, not on every page of this book, but certainly on many pages of it. Tell me, how did you come across the story of Robert de la Rochefoucauld?
I was reading his obituary in the New York Times, and the headline was something like, French aristocrat, resistance fighter, escaped death, and dressed like a nun. And I was like, what? So I basically had to read more. And the thing was, my wife and I, we had just moved. We had just had our twin boys. And for about 6 months after, well, basically for 6 months, I didn't do anything with that obituary. But I really wanted to write this book. I was working on another book at the time, and it had stalled. And when that other book finally stalled out permanently, I said, I've got to do this. And I didn't speak French at the time. And there were limitations. I wasn't going to be able to quit my day job, but my wife and I just decided I've got to do this because Robert's story was just so amazing.
Yeah. And so it seems like this should be obvious because this book is pretty thrilling, but I'm going to ask anyway. So what attracted you to telling his story besides the fact that he once dressed up like a nun?
So it's number of things. It's the fact that he is from the fourth oldest family in France. The La Rochefoucaulds, their names are like all over France. There's streets in Paris. I mean, they appear in Proust's books. I mean, they're just synonymous with France, old line moneyed aristocratic France. But then there was just really the thrilling, daring part of his exploits. When I began researching it and read through his memoir, which was published in French and never in English, one of the first questions I had was, this is unbelievable. And I meant that literally. Like, I was like, this is literally, I don't think this is true. So one of the first things I had to do was get a hold of the Ministry of Defense in Paris. And I didn't know, I was like, all right, if he got the medals that he said he received, then that's a pretty good indication, right? Because like all of that stuff would have been vetted by the French government. And basically it took months, but I found out, yeah, his story checked out because all the things that he said he received, all the commendations, they were there. I found paper trails for them. And so at that point, it was like, wow, I'm really sitting on something here that can be really good. But what ended up captivating me was actually something much smaller. And that was just this idea that during the occupation, if you lived through it, day by day, you did not know who was your friend or who was your foe. And the fact that Robert, a man of almost unimaginable means, a man who could have easily escaped and gone to another country or just fled to some locale where he wouldn't have been bothered. Money could have made sure that, you know, these things weren't an issue for him. He chose instead to become an active member of the resistance. And when I really started to dig into the research, I was like, why? Why did he choose to do this?
Right. And so, as I mentioned, the book is pretty thrilling, and I don't want you to give away too many of the secrets, I guess, but there are these three episodes where he escaped death, and one, he escaped from prison in the middle of the night. There are other episodes. Could you talk about one of those just to give our listeners a sense of what a commando this guy was?
Yeah, I'll talk a little bit about one. I don't think this is giving away too much. So Robert, he ended up being found by the Nazis in the early winter of 1943, like mid-December 1943. And he goes to this prison in the Yonne department in central France. And it's run by Nazis. And the stay there is, from what I can gather, absolutely horrific. I have to say from what I can gather, because his aristocratic forebears were such that they told him, you know, you don't ever mention pain. They were not supposed to cry. Crying was for the commoners, right? So in his memoir, what ends up happening is Robert does not discuss any of the treatment that he endured. But I spoke with some historians, and I was able to gather from other books the sense of like what it would have meant to have lived through 4 months in the Yonne prison at the time of the occupation. And it was horrific. The one thing the Nazis wanted to know is where he was keeping guns, who other members of the resistance were, and he did not give them up. And I know that because they ultimately decided to kill him. And there's a note in the prison file that a local historian helped me dig this up. And there's a note that said March 20th, 1944, and Robert was sent off to be executed. So this brings us back to like how much of a badass this guy was. Cool. So he had said next to nothing, so much so that the Germans didn't know who had trained him. And it was a secret group of British commandos on whom Ian Fleming ultimately based James Bond. These guys were known as Special Operations Executive, or SOE for short. And Winston Churchill helped form this group. And basically, they were supposed to foment anarchy by any means in their native country. The Brits would train these guys in England, and then they'd parachute them back to the continent where they would just, you know, everything and anything would be fair game, right? The SOE was also known as the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. So, very sort of daring sort of dudes. Robert said nothing, and when he's going to his execution...
And we should say that, you know, when you mentioned that he said nothing, I mean, that's after months of torture, right?
Robert doesn't say exactly what he endured, but I later heard from his daughter that, yeah, he had his teeth knocked out, and every other account that I read of people who were in the prison at that time talked about just horrendous torture. I mean, horrendous stuff. So anyway, he realizes on the morning of his execution, like a German priest has already given him his last rites, and he realizes as he's on the back of a truck, he's sitting on a coffin that he will soon occupy. He realizes the Nazis made one mistake, and the one mistake they made is they did not handcuff him. And there's an armed guard sitting on either side of him, and they're going down this Route Nationale, which cuts right through the heart of Auxerre, which is the name of the town where the Yonne prison was. And they're probably traveling at like, you know, 40, 50 miles an hour. And they're heading to this really remote path where like 43 people would ultimately be shot. And Robert he turns to this other prisoner who is going to be executed that day. And he says, whether it's now or later, I'm going to make another run for it. And the guy looks at him and is like, you're crazy. Like, what do you mean? And the Germans either didn't hear Robert because of the wind in the back of the truck, or they didn't speak French. I'm not really sure. But in any case, he's like, yeah, I'm going to do it. So he just rushes one of the guards knocks him over, then just jumps out of the back of the truck. And what's really funny is, so he jumps, he rolls, because he had this all this expert training, he actually knew how to do all this stuff, right? Like, he knew how to jump and roll from moving vehicles. He knew how to get back on his feet as quickly as possible. And so now the one guard has been leveled, but there's the second guard. And the second guard starts screaming, and he fires his rifle. And as he fires the rifle, Robert avoids like the first volley. And at the sound of that rifle, the driver of the truck freaks out because he's like, what's happening, right? So he slams on the brakes. And as he slams on the brakes, the second shooter, the guy who actually shot, you know, was shooting at Robert, isn't prepared for such a like a quick stop. And so he actually goes flying over the end of the truck too. And now Robert is running through the streets of Auxerre, you know, where he had been held prisoner for 4 months. And, well, I'm just going to say that he ends up getting in a lot more trouble and has to deal with Nazis in ways that he did not anticipate on two more occasions on just that day alone. Right. So yeah. So it's that sort of account where, to go back to what I was saying a minute ago, where I read his when I read his memoir, I'm like, this is not true. And then when I was talking with a local historian, he's like, well, let's look a little bit more. So we're looking through the prison records, and it says on a mark next to Robert's name, he escaped, or Ivad. Right. Oh. And I'm like, and he's like, he escaped that day. And then I was like, okay, so we started talking more about like where he would have been and like what he would have, would the account that he offered have been more right? And the historian is like, I didn't believe it first, but now we see this record, now that he talks about like the ways in which he navigated through the rest of that day, because the rest of that day was like just as crazy as the initial escape itself. He's like, I actually believe that Robert did do this. And so I was like, oh man, this is fantastic.
That's awesome. So it was difficult to pass the training regimen to become an agent of the British Special Operations Executive Force, which, as you said, Ian Fleming sort of based the Bond series on. But it wasn't really made up usually of aristocrats like La Rochefoucauld, right? I mean, one historian said it was made up of a range of people from, quote, pimps to princesses.
You found, Clay, actually my favorite quote of the SOE, yes. From pimps to princesses.
Yeah. So can you tell people a little bit about what the training would have been like?
So it would have been a few months at minimum at locations throughout the United Kingdom. There would have been some basic preliminary training in Scotland. There would have been a more advanced training. And so basically what it would have been is guys like Robert, they learned everything from lock breaking to how to jump out of a parachute to how to get back to a base without any compass or any way to guide you. They learned how to steal. They learned how to lie convincingly. They learned to never break a cover because, of course, that was actually the gravest offense of all. They were trained in every way, mental, physical, and I would say in the end, even spiritual. I mean, one of the guys who went through SOE's training ended up saying that one of the things that you came away from, you were going into this incredibly hostile, an incredibly dangerous environment if you were going back to France, right? Frankly, if you were going to any occupied nation. But you went there armed with this sense that you could defeat anyone. If you were a man of only average height, average weight, average strength, it did not matter. You could defeat any enemy that was placed in front of you because of this really expert training that they received from all facets of characters. Actually researching SOE was some of the, I mean, even though Robert's story is fascinating, just looking into like what that training would have been like, it was some of the most fun I had when I was researching.
Yeah. I want to ask you about this idea about freedom, because I think generally if you ask around nowadays, you know, liberals or conservatives, I think you generally find that people think we're living in, you know, some kind of dark times. And so when I read the section of your book about the prolonged torture that he endured, and you write that one way he survived that torture is because, quote, freedom is an idea that torturers cannot mangle, and a faith in it can help one stare through death. And those are your words. Those are not his words. But it made me feel so hopeful. And I wondered if writing this book sort of restored your faith in humanity. not that you ever lost it. I don't want to assume that. But
well, yeah, I mean, one of the things that looking into the occupation in World War II does is it makes you encounter the notion of what would it be like if we lived through those times, you know. And one of the questions I kept asking myself, just because I was faced with it on a daily basis, is would I have the courage to do what Robert did, to not only decide to serve in this underground where, you know, people who were caught, by the way, who are resistance fighters, faced far worse fate oftentimes than enlisted men or, you know, grunt soldiers or anything like that, right? Like Hitler and the Germans, they were going to torture them and they were going to kill them on only the slightest provocation. So to answer your question, yeah, I mean, to do what Robert did inspired me, right? Because and sometimes, like, there were many days where I didn't want to research it, right? Like, I had to keep my full-time job. I have a small and growing – I shouldn't say small, but I have young kids, and like, it was tough at certain times to find the time to balance everything. And as hokey as this sounds, you know, I would think, well, Robert went through a hell of a lot worse than I did. And so, yeah, I thought, yeah, like, that's something that's worth doing. About that line that you mentioned, you know, there's a faith to stare through death is a rough paraphrase as well as one of my favorite Wordsworth poems. It's the famous one, right? So I was always just taken with that idea. And Wordsworth meant it in a more religious sense, but I found the secular interpretation in the stories of a lot of resistance fighters. There was a great resistance fighter by the name of Jorge Sempron, who wrote a couple of amazing books. And a lot of it is about this idea of not betraying the people who think as you do, because they are the courageous ones and we must protect each other. And there was this brotherhood that was that they all sort of found themselves living by during the war and then well after.
So are there any plans to make a movie of this book? I mean, the only problem I can see is that I'm not really sure the audience would believe it, because as you said, his story is so insane.
Yeah, his story is insane. There is Cary Fukunaga of the guy who directed the first season of True Detective, which I love. And he did Beasts of No Nation a couple years ago. He's set to direct. And Michael Sugar, the producer for Spotlight, which won Best Picture a couple years ago, he's one of the producers who signed on as well.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens. Both of those guys are really busy, and they're still trying to line up a few things. But yeah, it's been those plans are in the works or they're in their tentative phases.
Yeah. And are you going to be involved, like script writing or anything, or are you just going to kind of let them do it?
I think I am going to mostly just let them do it. I do have interest in breaking into some of that stuff. I've been wanting to break into it for a little bit anyway. But, you know, as strange as this may sound, I actually don't know if this one is the one I would want to do it for, if only because it's not like I'm tired of Robert's story. Like, I'm happy to talk about it for hours if need be, because I just found his life so interesting. But I kind of feel like I told the story I wanted to tell and the medium I wanted to tell it in. And I want to let somebody else take a crack at doing it in another medium.
Right, right. So I'm interested in why you've footnoted this book. I mean, it's published by HarperCollins, a major publisher, trade publisher. You don't really have to footnote it. It's not an academic book. Is it because the story is so incredible, you were concerned that people might not believe it? And with the footnotes, it's very clear where your sourcing comes from?
Yeah, that's certainly a big part of it. And some of it's just my training too, right? Like whether I'm doing a story for ESPN or The New Yorker or any other magazine, a big part of it is just making sure that I have this as nailed down as I can. I tried to contact all of his family, for instance. I did contact all of his family members, and anything that they gave me that ended up making its way into the book, I double checked with them that I had it reflected accurately. I tried to do the best I could with the actual books themselves on which I relied. That's just sort of the part of it. But yeah, another part of it too is, you're right, Clay, like, his story was really crazy, was really amazing. And there's a few parts where I wanted, like, I worried that there were some issues over, like, which source I ended up trusting. I make a small point of this in the notes, that there are certain times where I actually vary from what Robert wrote in his memoir, in large part because I found military records that conflicted with what Robert was saying. So in terms of timing, and I think that's largely because Robert was never a very studious student, and he wrote the memoir with a ghostwriter. He also wrote it decades after the war, and I'm betting that, and his family doesn't know for sure, but I'm betting that Robert actually didn't rely on his own military records to write the book. And I ended up finding like 300 or 400 pages of them across France. And so that was another reason too. Like, there are some things that I wanted to do there. I was like, okay, I can spell this out in the notes because that means it won't slow down the book. And also with SOE, there's some question over, was Robert an official member? Was he just trained by them? And I tried to spell out my rationale for why I believed what I put on the page. I tried to do that in the notes.
Well, you did a great job. It's a really thrilling book and inspirational too. And I never say that. I don't like inspirational books. So you surprised me. So congrats. I hope it does really well. And thanks for your time.
Oh, thanks, Clay. I really appreciate it.
So that's a bit of history. I bet you didn't know, Megan. I certainly didn't know it.
That was totally bonkers.
Insane. Yes. Three times he escapes death, and each one really reads like a thriller movie plot. It's amazing. So that's, of course, why I asked him, you know, why did he footnote the book? Because I'm assuming that he was assuming that no one else would believe the story either.
Even with the footnotes, Clay, it's just on the edge of possibility for me.
Yeah, so true. I can see you as a British special operations executive agent for sure.
Well, thank you. That's super flattering.
Yeah. Cutting locks, killing people, you know, all of it.
The huge. I mean, pretty much what I do for my work now.
Yeah. Literary critic by day, assassin by night.
The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked.
There are 120,000 unsolved murder cases in America.
It was the next day that I found out from my parents what had happened, that my sister was killed.
Each one is called a cold case.
Sometimes you have to look really closely to find the evidence.
Damn it, I killed her.
Damn it, I killed her.
Cold Case Files, the podcast.
Garcia is walking into the home of a real monster.
I was nervous. I realized what kind of person I was dealing with.
It's a goosebump moment.
Download new episodes every Tuesday on the Podcast One app or subscribe at Apple Podcasts or podcastone.com.
This is Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Thanks for joining us.
So, who are you going to talk to today?
I have the pleasure of speaking with Fiona Mosley today, yeah. And I'm wicked excited about this. She, of course, is the author of Elmet, which was that debut novel that was nominated for the Man Booker Prize before it was even published. So we'll be speaking with her, and the book is coming out today in the United States.
Nice. Well, let's call her up.
In Elmet by Fiona Mosley, a family of three lives off the grid in a sylvan corner of Yorkshire. Daddy is a giant man of unmatched strength, a prizefighter and score settler whose ready violence belies his tenderness towards his teenage children. They are Kathy and her brother Daniel, 1 year younger. They've reclaimed wild land that once belonged to their missing mother, now legally owned by a rich man named Mr. Price, with whom Daddy is destined to come to blows. Mosley is a PhD candidate in medieval studies at the University of York and works weekends at the Little Apple Bookshop in town. Elmet is her debut novel, and it was shortlisted for the 2017 Man Booker Prize before it was even published. As our Kirkus critic writes in a starred review, Mosley's instantaneous success is a response to the stylish intensity of her work, which boldly winds multiple genres into a rich, spinning top of a tale. Fiona Mosley, welcome to Fully Booked. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. It's lovely to be here.
First things first, what is or what was Elmet?
Yeah, so Elmet is the name of the old Celtic kingdom that covered part of the north of England, where bits of Yorkshire now are and bits of Lincolnshire. And it was a kingdom that survived culturally, if not politically, throughout the Roman occupation of Britain. And it was only really defeated by invading Anglo-Saxons in around about the 7th or 8th century. So it's a historic place, but nobody knows all that much about it, and its boundaries aren't very well defined. I chose it as the title of the novel to give the reader a sense of antiquity, the antiquity of the place, and to suggest that the borders of the landscape have not always been the same, and that change has occurred and change is possible, I suppose.
Perhaps not always been the same, but there are certain themes that undoubtedly repeat themselves throughout history, which is something that the novel contends with.
Yeah, that's also the theme.
So what made this setting an enticing one for your novel?
I mean, it's very, very close to the place where I grew up. I grew up in York, where I now live, although I did spend time away from my hometown. And it's just it's the place that I was always going to write about. I think it's very familiar. It's a landscape that has a real literary heritage as well. You know, the Brontes, the sisters weren't far away. They write about these sorts of things. Ted Hughes also lived very nearby, and he was writing about the landscape. So it's got a rich heritage, and it's very close to my heart.
One of the things I found so interesting was the manner in which you write about what we would traditionally consider setting is really quite striking in this book. The land, the copse where Daddy, Kathy, and Daniel live, and the house that they live in, are almost treated like characters. Here's one example of what I'm talking about. The quote is, "The house was finding its position in the landscape, sitting down and relaxing into its trough, and we felt it sigh and moan for hours." What was your mindset in approaching writing about setting, land, the house?
Yeah, I certainly saw the house and the landscape as characters in the novel. So I'm really, really glad that you picked up on that. It's always really nice to know that readers are kind of getting out what you wanted to put in. I mean, the land is so important in the novel. This is a novel about characters, but it is they're characters whose lives are totally defined by the landscape, and things become very precarious for them because of this issue of land and living off the land and land ownership. So, you know, the setting had to be vivid, and I spent a lot of time trying to make it so, and I hope that's worked. But it really had to be a place that you could almost reach out and touch. That's what I wanted the reader to feel, and I wanted the reader to feel that whether they knew the landscape of Yorkshire, you know, what was Elmet, or whether they don't, whether they're from somewhere completely different. So yeah, it was something I worked long and hard at.
Oh, it worked. And in fact, I, as your reader, felt like I could smell it too. I live in Oregon, and I had the interesting experience of taking a break and reading to go shopping for a Christmas tree at a tree farm. So there's all that piney and resiny. In the book, I loved at a certain point, there's the smell of, I believe it was like rotted grass or stomped grass, you know, like, so it made me feel like I was almost outdoors at points.
Oh, fantastic. I'm glad you've said that. I also wanted to appeal to all of the human senses, which, you know, I really wanted it to be a place you could touch and as you say, smell. So that's really nice. And the rotting's a big part of it as well. I wanted to kind of evoke seasons and change. So things are constantly growing and then unfortunately dying and rotting, and then things are being reborn. So that's something I wanted to evoke.
So I gave a bit of this in the introduction, as you heard, but I'd like to ask you, for the benefit of our listeners, what is this book about?
Oh, yeah. So it's about a family who live on the margins of society. There are three main characters. There's the narrator, Daniel, who's a 14-year-old boy, and he lives with his sister, Kathy, who's a little bit older, and their dad, who they call Daddy throughout. And the three of them build a house themselves on land that they don't own, or their claim on that land is questionable. Because they, you know, they want to sort of survive by themselves and things. And that really, the drive of the novel is that is then challenged by local farmers, local landowners, who don't like the precedent that they're setting. And Daddy is a medical boxer. He earns a living from fighting in illegal bouts in muddy fields. He's a Goliath of a man. I really wanted for him to be fantastically large, you know, something from mythology. So yeah, this family live off the land and they have a really lovely existence until, you know, the men from thereabouts start to circle, and there's a showdown, shall we say?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
An unforgettable showdown. Is it asking too much for us to talk about the event that causes Daddy to decide to take the children into the woods?
No, I think, I mean, there is one event which is laid out, and that's quite early on. So I think it's okay to discuss that. That was quite a long time before he took them into the woods. But I wanted to sort of give the impression that it was things like that. Certainly. Yeah. Kathy, who's the daughter, is, I guess, being bullied, put very simply. And she fights back, which is something she's prone to do. She doesn't quite understand the rules of rules of the world, the rules of her gender, I guess. And she, not only does she fight back, but she wins. And everybody's slightly startled that she's managed to fight and beat these three boys. So she ends up getting reprimanded, and that's one of the things that Daddy really took objection to.
It seems that there are several notable instances in this book of others' views of Kathy being quite limited to stereotypes of, you know, girls and women, and they misjudge her to their own peril.
Yes, they do. That does happen repeatedly, and I think you know, we can talk about that incident at the beginning, but it certainly happens later on as well, which I guess we shouldn't dwell on for too long. But you're absolutely right that it's people underestimating her and also not believing her. You know, she sometimes there are points in the novel where she says things quite explicitly, and people say, "Well, that's not possible. That can't be." That can't be true, because their own preconceptions about people and about the social order seem to override what they're hearing or what they're even witnessing, which I think is something that's very, very interesting. And that's something, you know, that can be discussed in all sorts of ways. And I just sort of honed in on one particular aspect of it.
Someone who always believes Kathy is Daniel, of course.
Yeah.
Why did you choose him to narrate the story?
Yes, so I think of the three, he's the least glamorous in a way. But that's the very reason I chose him. He's a watcher. He observes what's going on, and he passes comment. You know, the characters of Daddy and Kathy could never narrate this story because they're far too involved in it. And they're not necessarily people who are very sort of internal. They don't necessarily reflect on things in the same way that Daniel does. They just go out and do things. So they're very, very different in temperament, the three of them, but particularly, you know, Daniel's very different from Kathy and Daddy, and he had to describe the story because he's the one who's seeing it, if that makes sense.
Sure. In a certain aspect, he does share something with Kathy, and that is not conforming to the rules of gender set forth for him, perhaps.
Yeah. I definitely wanted to suggest that, but I hope that I've done it with sort of subtle, I don't know, sort of light brushstrokes. He definitely doesn't necessarily see himself as a man, but he also doesn't have access to the kind of language that he might if he were older or living in a different place or had access to the internet and other books and things like that. So he kind of finds his own way to describe his relationship with his body and his sense of self. That's what I wanted to get across. I think all of the characters have slightly fraught relationships with their bodies. Daddy is someone who's very defined by his body, and the difficulty that his two children face is that their bodies don't necessarily conform to their identities or to their temperaments. There's some kind of internal antagonism within each of those characters because of the relationships between their bodies and their inner selves. If that makes sense.
It does. And it is my great misfortune that we are swiftly running out of time, because I feel like this is such a rich book. We could talk for hours. I feel like we didn't even get to scratch class. But it's a powerful book. It's a lyrical, beautiful book. And it's a truly surprising and breathtaking book. And it's one that won't soon leave me.
Oh, thank you. It's lovely to hear.
It's my pleasure. And for our listeners to find out more, they'll have to go and pick up a copy of Elmet, which is out today from Algonquin Books. Fiona, thank you so much once again for joining us on Fully Booked.
You're very welcome indeed.
Wow, I didn't realize this episode is our European episode from World War II France to England. Wow.
This is a really intense book play.
Yeah. That's certainly all the coverage about it. Makes it seem that way.
Do you have a copy?
I do. It's in the office.
Highly recommended.
All right. I will tackle it. All right. So let's bring on our editors.
Let's.
So we've got our senior editors on the line. We've got Vicky Smith, who is our children's and teen editor, Laurie Muchnick, our fiction editor, and Eric Liebetrau, our nonfiction editor. And Vicky, last week's episode was the Texas Book Festival episode. That was also the week that we launched the best middle grade books of the year. And so you didn't get a chance to talk about those in last week's episode. And this week is when we are launching your picks for the best teen books of the year. So you want to talk to us a little bit about the best middle grade books of the year and the best teen books. Is that right?
Sure. You've got time for all 150, right?
That's right. Just title by title would be great.
Absolutely. I can do it. So I did limit myself to two in each category. And I thought, since this is the time of year that kids are winding down school and looking at a week or two of vacation, that I would talk about thrillers and mysteries. And so the first book, the first two are going to be middle grade and the second two are going to be for teens. And the first book I want to talk about is The Harlem Charade by Natasha Tarpley. And this is a sort of mystery adventure that takes place in Harlem, as you may guess from the title. It's got three main characters and they all, the point of view shifts among the three of them. Jean is a Korean girl and she spends most of her time in the afternoon in her grandparents' bodega, which gives her an excellent opportunity to observe the world around her. And when she observes a black girl named Alex from her class who sticks a free Metro card to a jar of pickles, that starts an adventure that eventually pulls in a boy named Elvin, whose grandfather is in a coma in the hospital. And the kids learn that the grandfather's coma was caused by an attack that is somehow or other connected to a rare painting. So this sends the kids all over Harlem and into Harlem's history, and particularly into Harlem's artistic history, in a really neatly tied together book that looks at sort of modern development pressures and the importance of maintaining history, and is just a rock solid, very character driven mystery.
Awesome.
So that's the Harlem Charade by Natasha Tarpley.
Yeah.
The second book I want to talk about is an odd one. It's called The Murderer's Ape, and it's by Jakob Vigelius and translated by Peter Graves from Swedish. And it takes place about 100 years ago. And the main character is an ape named Sally Jones, who works with her partner, a sailor named Henry Koskela, who is falsely accused of murder, hence the murderer's ape. And the story is how Sally, who's able to type her story very slowly on an old Underwood, goes about solving this mystery. And it's an engaging mystery and just this absolutely mesmerizing main character. It's a thick book. The reviewer said short attention spans need not apply, but committed, careful readers will be richly rewarded. It's really a one of a kind.
Nice.
Moving into teen books.
Yeah.
There is A Line in the Dark by Melinda Lowe. Jess Wong, who's Chinese American, has had this unrequited crush on her white best friend, Angie, forever, which means that she is really not happy when Angie starts dating Margot, who's a wealthy white girl at a nearby private school. Jess can't make herself be happy for her friend. And then when Margot's friend is discovered murdered in the park, sort of all of these relationships sort of come together and shift and make for this incredibly creepy, exciting thriller. The reviewer says that it's colored with intersecting hues of Chinese American identity, the dark intensity of relationships, and telltale stains of blood.
Oh.
So, yes, don't read it at night.
Yeah, a little
and
blood.
The final, yeah, just a little. It's got a very creepy cover. I recommend everybody look at the cover.
Oh, awesome. Okay.
And the final book I want to talk about is Disappeared by Francisco X. Stork, and it takes place in Juarez. The main characters are Sara de Zapata and her younger brother Emiliano. And Sara is a journalist, and she sort of starts the story going by writing about her best friend who's been kidnapped by the cartels. And this brings a lot of support from the community and a lot of death threats from the cartels. And meanwhile, Emiliano is, he's a real go-getter. He's still in high school. He plays soccer. He's got a little side business selling artisanal crafts, but he really, really needs more money in order to date his crush, who is the daughter of one of the wealthy, powerful men in town. And so he becomes tangled up in the cartels. And this obviously does not make life easy for Sara. And eventually they have to split Juarez. And it's this real pulse-pounding sort of adventure as they make their way through the desert to what they hope will be safety. So one of the things that our reviewer loved most about the book, and I really agree with him, is that even the evil characters, they're not one-dimensional monsters. You understand why they do monstrous things. And it's just a really fabulous, nuanced mystery.
Yeah, well, that's what we like.
Mm-hmm.
The nuance. All righty, well, thank you. You've covered a lot of ground today.
Well, just 146 to go.
Yeah.
Brava, brava. Turning now to fiction. Hey, Lori.
Hey, Megan, how are you?
I'm okay. How you feeling?
Good, pretty good.
Okay, glad to hear it. What's your top pick for a fiction book this week?
Well, I was really happy to see this book on the list because it's the end of the year and not tons of new books are coming out because the publishers are trying to get them all into the stores in time for the holidays. So
totally.
This, what I'm going to talk about is Future Home of the Living God by Louise Erdrich.
Cool.
Which, you know, obviously she's a big, well-known author who's won the National Book Award, the National Book Critics Circle Award. I think that the reason the publisher is bringing this out so close to the end of the year is that apparently she started writing this book like 15 years ago and put it aside and just brought it out after the election. And it seemed very appropriate to the time. So she quickly kind of did some revision and rushed it out quite quickly. It's different from Erdrich's usual fare. It's a dystopian novel in which evolution is moving backwards. All kinds of strange things are happening. the government of the United States is called the Church of the New Constitution, and they start rounding up all the pregnant women and trying to contain them. The main character, who's the narrator, who's writing the book as kind of a letter to her unborn child, is a woman named Cedar Hawk Songmaker, who, as I said, is pregnant. She's 26. She's a Native American who's been adopted by a liberal Minneapolis family. She's trying to figure out what's going on in the world, why they particularly seem to want her and her baby. At the same time, she's trying to get to know her birth family and find out what's happened to her adoptive family, who seem to have sort of disappeared. So there's a lot of things going on. Our reviewer said that, you know, even though this is different from Erdrich's previous work, she hasn't used sci-fi kind of tropes before. Her inexperience does not show here. It's a really beautifully created world, and it's full of, the book is full of profound spiritual questions and observations, and just is very captivating and also hopeful at the end. There is hope for salvation here. So
that's so interesting. There's something that I hear every now and again from, you know, novelists and, you know, who I'm interviewing, and they say, you know, well, you can't decide what, you know, kind of world your book is born into because it's such a long labored process, could take many years. But sometimes you can decide ish.
That was really interesting that, you know, when she wrote it in around 2003, it didn't seem to be working for her, but she took it out again and now seemed to be the time. So she reworked it and pushed it out. So there you go.
Look forward to that one. What will we not be looking forward to this week?
Well, a book that if you are too busy, you can give a miss to is Artemis by Andy Weir. He's the author of The Martian, which you might remember was a real fun book and also a movie starring Matt Damon. This isn't, unlike Erdrich, he's not doing anything really different. This is another off-world tale set on a colony on the moon. The main character is a woman named Jasmine, who's in her 20s, and she's living in this colony set in a few bubbles on the moon. And there's all kinds of, she's trying to, you know, make some money a bit sort of on the black market. And she has a client who asks her to do various things. And then he's found murdered. You know, our reviewer said that basically, if you strip away the science fiction trappings, this is basically a by-the-numbers caper novel with little suspense. If you're expecting the Martians, you know, one of the most interesting things about The Martian, I thought, and I think a lot of people thought, was the smart math and science problem solving and just how interesting he made that. And that's missing here. So it's nothing special.
I don't know if it was a full-blown tweet storm, but I caught him catching a little bit of flack for that New York Times by the book that he did. You see that?
I did see that. He did an interview with The Times. You know, every week they talk about what, they ask authors what they're reading, and everything he was reading was really kind of standard old school science fiction by, you know, dead white men, basically Isaac Asimov, Heinlein, people like that, which I know I saw a lot of people online calling him out for having a really boring list and feeling like he should be immersing himself in some of the more contemporary strains of science fiction by a wider array of writers. To put it in a nice way, a wider array.
He should visit Kirkus.com.
He definitely should.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
All right. So, Eric, your list of the best nonfiction of the year is going to be out next week.
Correct.
So, until then, is there a book on the bestseller list you think we ought to race out and buy?
Well, forgive me, but I'm going to go with two political books. Well, politics focused. Though the first one is Joe Biden's new book called Promise Me Dad, A Year of Hope, Hardship, and Purpose. And, you know, while it's by a political figure and he does cover some of the things in his career, he covered most of them in his previous book. And this one is really about, it's extremely personal, candid. It's a very sad book, but also uplifting in his approach, because most of it is about the death of his son, Beau, from a long lingering cancer in 2015. And I think what a lot of other people don't, or some people don't know about him, is that he had also lost his first wife and baby daughter in a car accident a couple decades prior. So he certainly experienced plenty of personal tragedy, but he kind of strikes a hopeful note toward the end. And even a reviewer says that could this signal an opening salvo in the 2020 presidential campaign? Huh. Many readers will hope so. And there's also some good, there's good stuff about his relationship with Obama. He goes into how, as our reviewer said, he's not always an easy man to work with, but a supremely principled one. So it's about 250 pages. So it's a pretty quick read, but surprisingly powerful.
Nice. And so another political book you think we should avoid?
I would take a pass on Donna Brazile's book, Hacks.
Mm.
It's very much in the news, has been. It's hit the list. Our reviewer says that there's a lot of finger pointing and not a lot of it reflects well on many of the figures in the 2016 campaign. But the reviewer said it's a messy, self-serving rationalization of one of the biggest debacles in recent American political history. Of course, it's about the subtitles, the inside story of the break-ins and breakdowns that put Donald Trump in the White House. Mm-hmm. A reviewer said that there aren't really that many bombshells to be had. It just seems that Brazil is angry and she wants everybody to know it. And so there's a lot of mudslinging, but not much on the way of real analysis.
Yeah. And the way that the news, you know, that the, I guess she or the DNC or the publisher tried to break the news about this book, I mean, immediately became suspect. So
it did. Yeah, it was kind of a disaster from the start.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate because we're all kind of looking for some more clarity on what happened.
We are.
Oh, and if you want to know what happened, read Hillary's book.
Right.
Turner. Yeah. That's the title.
You're a politics expert today. All right. Well, thank you. So we hope you join us next week in the December 12th episode. You know what to do now. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.
The Serial Killer Podcast, hosted by me, Thomas Vyborg Thune, is the podcast dedicated to serial killers, who they were, what they did, and how. Join me as I sit down bi-weekly to bring you, dear listener, into the dark land of serial murder and psychopathy. The show goes into graphic detail on the most infamous and lesser-known serial killers from around the world, with each episode covering one unique serial killer. So far, the show has covered serial killer superstars, such as BTK, Jeffrey Dahmer, and the Yorkshire Ripper, and lesser-known killers, such as Elias Abuelazam and Anatoly Onoprienko. Be advised, this show is not for children, as it takes you deep into the twisted world of ultimate evil. You can find me exclusively at podcastone.com or on the new Podcast One app. Also, don't forget to rate and review on Apple Podcasts.